Ladies and gentlemen, our next comic you're going to love. She's a funny lady from Hartford, Connecticut. Give it up for Kyone Wolf. Yeah.
Thank you. It's great to be back in Phoenix. And I'm noticing it's still hot here, you guys. There's like no progress on the hotness thing, huh? But tonight I want to try something super special, something I've never tried before. I'm going to ask you in the audience to call out a word, any word, and I'll do a stand-up routine based on that one word. So, let's go. Give me a word. Anybody.
Rhinoceros.
Okay. What is it? It's just standing there. You think maybe it's some kind of a plant? It has body armor, but... Let's say you're sitting next to a rhinoceros on an airplane. Okay, different word.
Statistics.
Do you mean like statistics?
Yes, but I have a hard time saying that word.
You call that a word that you're not really comfortable saying? You could have picked like any word in the language that you speak. I mean, why didn't you just say dictionary or housekeeping?
Well, I just really like statistics.
Okay. It's happening to me too. Statistics. Everybody hates statistics, but I love them. Do you know why? Different word.
Maybe fire?
Fire, okay. The first caveman who discovered fire, he totally must have thought...
No, I mean there's a fire back here by our table.
You're yelling fire?
No, the waiter's trying to put it out. I think he may have it under control. That's why I said, maybe fire.
You know, just in terms of trying to establish a flow of momentum, I'm having problems. Wait a minute, I just thought about something funny about a rhinoceros. They look so pissed off all the time, but if you give them a Lexapro... Okay, I lost the thread of that one. Anyway, I want to bring out a very funny guy. He's coming off a triumphant three-week run at Chuckleheads on Long Island. And if you tried the buffet there, you'd have 3 weeks of runs, too. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Colin Rhinoceros.
It's McEnroe, actually. All right, so this is our annual, I think we do it every year, and if not, we should start doing it every year, our annual fall comedy episode. And there's a lot to talk about here, and we're really excited to have with us Jason Zinnemann. Jason Zinnemann is the first ever comedy critic for the New York Times. He's the author of the book, the e-book, Searching for Dave Chappelle. Jason Zinnemann, maybe just a moment to talk about your job itself. I'd say by about 1972, every newspaper in America had at least one rock critic, but comedy critics, maybe not so much. And is the fact that you exist and you now exist in a place like the New York Times, does that say something about the comedy scene itself, just the sheer explosion of different ways to watch and appreciate comedy?
I think that's definitely a big part of it. I think it became too big a part of the culture to ignore from a critical point of view. But I also think there's just to be perfectly frank, there's a sort of institutional failure by the press to across the board to cover comedy, live comedy, stand-up, improv, from a critical point of view in the way that they've covered dance or opera or theater. I mean, basically, if you look at someone like Jerry Seinfeld, before Jerry Seinfeld had a television show, he was tremendously successful, famous comic in his natural art form, which is live stand-up. And nobody at, you know, the LA Times or the New York Times regularly covered, you know, successful live stand-up. So he didn't really get a lot of critical attention until he had a television show. And same is true with someone like Louis C.K. It's just people were written about the features about them, or there would be occasionally roundups or this kind of story. But it's a stand-up comedy, particularly, is a very odd art form because the way to get famous at it is to go into a different art form, you know, TV or movies. And so part of the idea of this column was that to, you know, write about these great artists doing their work before they shift into another form.
You know, one of the ways that they get famous, obviously, is if they make it to Saturday Night Live, which is kind of you can sort of look at a lot of the club comedy as just an improv comedy as this huge feeder system that ends with Saturday Night Live. They started their new season on Saturday night, and they're adding 6 featured players, which is an unusually large influx of new talent. This is something we've talked about before on this show with Eric Deggans, but I found myself just to sort of get into an unfunny topic for a second, I was sort of put off by the fact that they were six white people, five of them guys, and I've been watching Saturday Night Live since I was in college in the 1970s. I'm not sure I've ever seen a black woman in the cast, and Latinos have been few and far between. And you just sort of wonder if just in, you know, it's like Saturday Night Live seems behind the National Republican Party in terms of inclusiveness. Is that something you've thought about?
No, it's something I've definitely thought of. It's something I've written about. I mean, I think, you know, the question is, why is that, right? Why is that? And to you put your finger on it, which is that the people who get on Saturday Night Live, they generally come out of certain institutions. Increasingly, it's these improv institutions, whether it's Second City or UCB, or Groundlings, and, you know, what is the makeup of those institutions relative, you know, what's the class makeup, what's the racial makeup? I mean, one of the more controversial stories I've written was about how, you know, the Upright Citizens Brigade doesn't pay anybody on stage. And one of the connections I made, which was that, you know, if you're going into something where there's no hope of ever getting paid unless you teach at it or you make it on Saturday Night Live, then it draws a much more narrow, a particular pool of talent. I think that's part of the reason. I mean, I think you see more diversity in stand-up slightly than you do in improv. I think also, I do think a lot of it has to do with the sort of funneling, how these places funnel in. At the same time, you know, ultimately, I think to really look at that, you have to look at, you know, Lorne Michaels and what he was looking for. And, you know, to get more detailed about, I think, you know, two of those members were from a comedy team. And, to really examine it. But there's no question that, diversity in comedy is a huge subject. And, you know, some of it's starting to change. I mean, but some of it isn't. If you look at all these new late night hosts, it still is very – you know, all these new late night hosts, where there's been very few female late night hosts in the history of late night television. Why is that?
Yeah, and I just back to Saturday Night Live for a second. I mean, I thought it was a very funny first episode. They did some terrific things. But, you know, they've got two black members of the cast. Jay Farrow is relegated almost entirely to his Obama impersonation, is rarely used for much of anything else. And there's an odd kind of lack of equilibrium, so that Kenan Thompson, who's a very, very funny comedian, in this kind of otherwise wholly white context, some of his stuff, it's almost borderline step and fetch it. He's like doing this bit about how big his wife's ass is on introducing an old movie or something. And I'm thinking, this could be really funny in a more diverse setting somehow. Here, it's almost like though they've made the mistake of creating an environment where Kenan Thompson can't even be as funny as he really is.
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I wouldn't go that far, but I would say it was a better situation when you had, like, Saturday Night Live and In Living Color. Saturday Night Live and Mad TV, where you had, In Living Color, which wasn't all black at all. It didn't carry, but you had, that would be the kind, and you could argue some of their, and you could argue even if you have a predominantly black cast, you can actually take more risks in terms of doing racial humor.
Yeah,
way that female comedians can take, in some ways, more risks in certain humor about gender. There is, you know, diversity in comedy is, I think this is something I believe very strongly, it's not just about fairness, it's about the art of it. That if you have people from many different backgrounds, not just in terms of race, but in terms of gender and class, you have people from different points of view and different kinds of shows, that will lead, I believe, even different, you know, makeups in the writer's room. It will lead to better work.
We're talking to Jason Zinnemann. He's the first ever comedy critic for the New York Times. So if you want to see really crazy funny stuff that's a little less focus grouped, maybe, obviously that's what you do. You go out there and see the innovators. Who do you like right now? Who excites you?
Oh, man, well, there's... so many people, and it's a fantastic time. I mean, you know, there's everything from, I mean, Hannibal Buress, I think, is absolutely brilliant comic at the top of his game.
We've got a little clip, a little Hannibal Buress clip here, just to sort of give people a little taste of Hannibal Buress. If you're ready, Wolfie, here he is.
I like my job, I write. We have interns at the job. You tell them to do stuff, and they do it. It's great.
But you got to be nice to him, though. I just got faxed something. Hey, man, fax that for me. I gave him another page. Hey, fax something for yourself, too. I was leaving work one day. I got on the elevator going down. It stopped on 3. This man got on and was like, thank you. And I was like, what are you thanking me for? I don't work on the elevator. This ain't Mad Men. Why are you talking to me? Why are you thanking me to get on the elevator? What is your life like? Do people usually push you off the elevator? I get off the elevator, man. Stairs for you. It's always been stairs. You need to work on your calves anyway. Why are your calves flabby? We haven't let you take the elevator in 6 years.
That's Hannibal Buress. Jason Zinnemann, just quickly, tell us what you like about him. What do you think he's doing well?
Well, I mean, he's got an incredibly, at this point, an incredible onstage confidence. You know, the guy can handle anything. He can tell the same joke slightly differently, you know, 4 different times and get laughs different ways. He's got a really distinctive delivery that is different than other comics. He, you know, when I first saw him, what stood out is that he had a kind of slow drawl delivery, but he could also, you know, do different styles very effectively. And then I think there's also just like a real, intelligence to his humor. He's, you know, his comedy is real smart and off kilter, and he can do, you know, he can cover really mundane, boring territory like airplane jokes and make it really funny. You know, he's got that thing that all the great comics have, which is that he can get laughs on the way to a joke. You know, before. Laughs that no one else can get. It's not about the punchline, you know, but while he also has a lot of great punchlines. So he's one of these people who I wrote about, you know, 2 years ago. Actually, my first column was about him. And I think he now has a deal with Comedy Central. And he's just one of these guys who hasn't quite found the vehicle to sort of, you know, rocket him to stardom. But if I was a betting man, I would say that's going to happen.
It seems like that's a typical arc, too, and it doesn't always seem to work out that well. You see people who are fabulous at stand-up, and then they get a contract with Comedy Central, and then they're doing a show that somehow or other doesn't quite bring forth their gifts quite the same way that stand-up did. You may have a different opinion about this. I was just knocked out very early on just seeing clips of Amy Schumer doing stand-up. She gets a contract to have her own show, and it's somehow it's sort of harder to get the thing that she did so well in stand-up.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that, but I would with that in particular. I like her show, and I also like her stand-up. But I do think you're absolutely right. The general point is absolutely right, which is that there's nothing, and this I think is part of, you know, central to my job, which is that I think for the form of your work really matters. That just because you're a good stand-up doesn't mean you're going to be good as an actor, as a movie star, just because you're good at improv doesn't mean you're good at going to be good at SNL. And I also think that, for me, stand-up at its best is a live form. I don't think, in some ways, I think one problem with stand-up is most people learn about it through TV. Mm-hmm. And it just has a completely different feel. Just in the same way you see a play, a filmed play, it's not the same. You can't say you've actually seen a play if you've seen someone, a videotaped version of it. And that's just true. You know, there's just a different feel to live stand-up, a different energy. There's a looseness to it. So I do think, you know, not every project's the same. And you know, Schumer's, her assets on the sketch show are different than her assets on stand-up, but I think what you see her trying to do, more so than I would say even Chappelle, is that she incorporates a lot of her stand-up into her show.
Let's just hear a little bit of Amy Schumer's stand-up just for people who are untutored by all this. This is Amy Schumer.
People always assume that I'm shallow because I'm really pretty. But no, I'm really not. I'm not shallow at all. Like, the guy I'm seeing right now isn't even good-looking. I'm serious. No one's ever like, who's that? They're like, what happened? Is he ill? Should we call someone? I've never cared about that stuff, you know? And he's so rich that it doesn't come up. I can't hear him with the bag. But I've been thinking about getting some work done to him, and I think I'm gonna do it. No, he's really cute. He looks like one of the guys from The Hills Have Eyes. So, yeah, it's great. No, the truth is, right now I'm going through a breakup. Well, he doesn't know yet. Technically, I'm just cheating on him. But it's weird.
It's Amy Schumer. You know, Jason Zinnemann, another thing that we've sort of seen in recent years are women like Amy Schumer and Sarah Silverman, who are really attractive women, sexy women. So for so long, funny women kind of had to be people who sort of made fun of their own looks. Even on Saturday Night, Tina Fey made a joke about herself that, you know, was like right out of the Phyllis Diller playbook. But it's sort of interesting to hear a woman like Amy Schumer do a routine about a man who's ugly and what she's going to do to him.
Yeah, no, I think you really see, you know, Amy Schumer is a great example of what you can get away with from a female point of view, which you couldn't other. I actually did a long story on her show, which I sat in her writer's room for many months, and I talked to the executives of Comedy Central a lot. And, you know, the thing about Comedy Central is most of its audience is men. Mm-hmm. So in order to have a successful show, you need to appeal to men along with women. And, you know, Sarah Silverman had a show on Comedy Central, which canceled after a few years. And I think, you know, some of their calculus was that they saw, and it turned out to be correct, that Schumer would have more crossover appeal. I think her demos are sort of equal, men and women. Now, is part of that because her looks? I don't know. I mean, I think she does have a quality of kind of like, I think she's attractive, but she also has a very relatable quality. I think that she, that I think definitely comes across for men and women. I paid a lot of attention in seeing Glenn Hirsty shows at the audience reaction. And my sense was that, like, the women were connected more than men, but men also liked her. But, you know, you see both with Silverman and Schumer, for instance, you know, like rape jokes are very controversial. And you see that they both make incredibly risque rape jokes that I'm not sure male comics can get away with.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of her looks, Amy Schumer, I'll have to rephrase this a little bit, but she talks about her own, but sort of where she falls in the spectrum. She says, she's talking to some guy in the audience. She says, "Yeah, you'd do me, but then you wouldn't blog about it."
right. That was one of the first jokes I ever saw her say, and I love that joke. Also, just because of the way it sounds.
Like, right.
There's something about the blog and the. I mean, one of the things, Schumer has a fantastic delivery. She's very smart. Like, but a lot of what I like about her is that she's the sound of her jokes are really funny. She knows how to choose just the right word for a punchline.
As long as you're talking about women comics, I want to play a little clip by Maria Bamford. I was talking to one of my friends out in San Francisco who's involved in the comedy scene out there and kind of tells me who he likes. And he was describing her as kind of a Jonathan Winters for this generation. Let's hear a little of Maria Bamford.
I have felt like I've been a success in life. And you know when you feel like you've been a success and then you go home to your hometown and you meet your arch enemy, Christy Coombs from high school at Target, and you realize nothing's changed at all, and you're still the great big hose beast you always were.
So I saw you on TV or whatever. It's just like in high school. It's like, you're not funny, you're just weird.
Well, comedy is a subjective, it's an art form.
So are you gay? Because I heard a lot of women comedians are gay.
No, I'm not gay. It'd be okay if I was, but I'm not.
Oh, that's good. Because remember, we all went to Christian Bible camp. We all went skinny dipping that one night, and you wouldn't take your shirt off. And I'm like, oh my God, you got nothing to show anyway. And then you took it off, and we all give you twisters. I was like, oh my God, if you were a lesbo, you'd have been all turned on by that. And then I just got all grossed out. Press debit or credit.
Booyah!
All right, Jason Zinnemann, tell us about Maria Bamford.
Definitely one of the most talented, eccentric performers in Comedy Today. I mean, she's great. I think Winters is a really interesting comparison. She has, you know, a lot of voices. You know, she's a great straight stand-up. But I think actually her greatest work is, it's funny. Think about Maria Bamford. Her masterpiece, I think, is she did this web series, which was all in her, I think it was in her parents' house, but it was all about, and all the, where she played, like, you know, I don't know how many dozens of characters who were all people from her childhood. She played her mom, she played her dad, she played her friends. And it was just, they were all, most of the shots were kind of close-ups. And it was character work. So, I mean, there's a little Jonathan Winters, there's also a little bit, I would say, like, Lily Tomlin or, you know, Whoopi Goldberg, that you had this, like, really fully realized world she created, full of instantly recognizable characters. And, of course, there were a lot of jokes, but they were sort of in service to the story and this world. And, you know, it was all done just with, like, very simple, you know, camera work. And, it shows, she's a real example of someone to show, like, how much you can accomplish with just one comic voice. The other thing which she did, which was really interesting, her last comedy special was something I'd never seen before. She performed in her parents' house to an audience of just her parents on the couch. And some of her jokes, you know, she plays her parents. And, you know, it was a very traditional stand-up show in all these ways, but just changing this dynamic with the audience had a huge impact, because just on the sound of it, because if a joke kills, you just hear a few laughs, and you're so used to thinking, oh, a joke kills if you hear this big roar, or sometimes it'd be no laughs, because two people don't like a joke, or you're just quiet. So she, in a lot of ways, is both very, very personal and works on her own life and background, and also at the same time is kind of, you know, really is willing to take risks and experiment.
All right, Jason Zinnemann, so great to talk to you. So many more comedians that you've turned me on to that I want to talk to you about in the future. I hope you will come back. I spent some of the time today watching clips of Reggie Watts, who I didn't know anything about and who is, talk about another Jonathan Winters. But anyway, we got to take a quick break here. Let me just tell you what's coming up. Later in the show, you're going to hear Colin Mochrie and Brad Sherwood. They're both graduates of Whose Line Is It Anyway? They're going to be performing here in Connecticut later in the week. But coming up next, Sammy Obeid. He's a stand-up comedian who just finished performing 1,001 stand-up shows in a row. We'll tell you about that. I'm not just wild, I'm trained, domesticated. I was raised by a rapper and writer that dated and subsequently procreated. That's how it goes. Here's the hip-hop-hopotamus, the hip-hop-hippo.
They call me the hip-hop-hopotamus. My lyrics are bottomless.
All right, we're back. Joining us now, as I said, is Sammy Obeid. He's attracted quite a bit of acclaim lately for undertaking this Herculean quest to do 1,001 stand-up shows in a row, sometimes actually putting, at least once anyway, putting his personal safety online to complete one of those shows. We'll tell you about that as we go along here. But first of all, welcome to the show. By all accounts, you were kind of a math and science guy who sort of wondered if you could apply some of the same thinking that works in math and science to the world of comedy. Tell us about the genesis of this whole project.
That is correct. Hey, by the way, I like the Herculean. That's a great word. I never thought of that. I graduated from UC Berkeley. I majored in applied math and business. I was always a math and sciences guy, never really a language guy. But you know, I started comedy about a year after graduating because it was just something that I could do, and I didn't want to work a job, like a tech job. I got an offer at Google, and I didn't want to do it, so I turned it down. And I started doing comedy, and, you know, after a while I was good, but I was like, you know, it's really, the industry is really hard. I mean, you have to stand out somehow. You have to get lucky, and none of that was really happening for me, so I just decided that I had to work harder. So I just decided I'm going to get up every night. I'm going to perform every night. And I did that and just kind of saw how far I could go. And, you know, I was 100 days in. I was like, you know what, I think I'm going to do 365. And then I get to 365, and I thought that was, you know, that was a big deal. But then on day 365, some fellow comedian told me that one time another comedian did 2 years in a row, and I never, you know, verified if it was true or not, but I didn't want to take a risk, so I decided, well, I'll try and beat that. And then, you know, if I'm going to go past 2 years, which is 730 days, I think I'll round up and set it at 1,000 days because that kind of sounds cool, 1,000 days of comedy. And then that's what I did. I just set out to do that goal, to hit 1,000 days, and I just recently did about a week ago.
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things that a computer does, obviously, is run a lot of different variables and starts knocking out things that don't work. And you're kind of doing that many shows over such a short period of time. Did it allow you to do that, to sort of begin selecting out things that didn't work and keeping things that did?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, I did that before I even started this thing. That's always been my process in comedy. You know, I never really watch other people's processes or learn much about them, but I'm pretty sure that I'm a little more syntactical than the most. I, when I started out comedy, I would have a list of things I would do. I would do them, and then I would line by line go through them and see, you know, what got a laugh, what didn't. If it got a laugh, I'd write a plus by it. If it didn't get a reaction, I'd put a zero. And if it got a negative reaction, I'd put a negative. And then I'd go through that, and I would just cut out all the stuff that wasn't getting laughs. And it's a trial and error process, and that's kind of how I put together my set day after day.
Did doing so many sets over 1,001 days, straight stand-up sets, did that also begin to tell you things about the actual structure of jokes? I mean, obviously, you have a system for getting rid of the bad stuff, keeping the good stuff.
Yeah.
But then you start thinking about sort of what actually makes something a good thing and worth even trying out in a process like that. Did you learn more about that?
Absolutely. You know, I think anything in comedy can be reduced to some kind of systematic equation. You know, I think generally people, you know, comedians, we do comedy, we just kind of go by gut feeling, like what's funny. And, most comedians don't even think about this stuff, I'm sure. They just kind of go up there and say something, and it's funny. But I think for everything, there is a reason by it. There's a reason, you know, is it a misdirection? Is it a funny word arrangement? What is it? What are the factors that are going into that make it funny? And, you know, I mean, I kind of came up with a list of things that were just the tricks employed in most jokes.
Give us an example of one of your jokes and then just kind of tell us what it is that you're seeing structurally in it.
Sure, sure. So one of my jokes is I'm a big supporter of gay rights. I just threw my friend Kyle a coming out party. It was a surprise party, but someone had to tell him. The mechanisms there is, first of all, it's a misdirection. It's a slight misdirection because you're not really sure where I'm going. And then also it's a play on the different kinds of parties. Mm-hmm. It's like what, you know, it's kind of like a Mad Libs in a lot of ways. Like what do you do when you get a coming out party that's also a surprise party, you know? So there's a bit of semantics involved as well. For every joke, you can always look at what the mechanism is, and I think there's a logical explanation for everything.
We're talking to Sammy Obeid right now. Obviously, to put together a streak like this, I mean, if you wanted to play tennis every day for 1,001 days, there'd be days it was raining, days when you just couldn't find a tennis court wherever you were. You did have that problem, at least once notably, where you were making this rule that you had to do stand-up in a real comedy venue of some kind, and suddenly you found yourself without a venue. Talk about that.
Yeah, there's been a few times that happened, and, you know, one of the most notable was a time when I was in San Francisco. I couldn't find a show on a Sunday night, or my show got canceled, and I had to scramble around and find a place to put me up, and I came across an Irish bar where I had performed once at an open mic and had a shoe thrown at me, which, you know, you would think as a sign not to go there again, but I really didn't have many choices. You know, so I go there, and they're doing karaoke, and I ask the DJ if I could, you know, stop the karaoke for 5 minutes and do some jokes. And he said, all right, why not? And, you know, after a few minutes getting into it, it was clear that the people at the bar were not a fan of me or the idea of comedy at that point in the night. It seemed like they really wanted their karaoke. It became hostile. They started cursing and yelling at me, telling me to get off stage. Finally, a guy came up to me, and he put out his fist like he was going to give me a fist bump, and then he punched me in the stomach, grabbed the mic, and threw it on the ground. And then the DJ didn't really know what to do, so he just turned back on the music. But I had already done my set at that point, so it was kind of a victory for me.
You were free and clear. Hey, just a last question before we're going to run out of time here. But did the quest itself become part of your material? In other words, I mean, that's a pretty funny story, or certainly could be sharpened into an even funnier story. Did the project become comic material?
Yeah, it did. Well, in a lot of ways. I have a lot of stories from the streak that I've compiled, and you know, I've done it some storytelling shows. And I'm also writing a book about the whole experience, which, you know, I'm hoping people will find humor in, because there is a lot of funny stuff in it. So,
all right. Well, this is fabulous. And Sammy Obey, it's so much, so interesting, so great to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time with us. Let me just sort of tell you what else we've got coming up here. We've got Colin Mochrie and Brad Sherwood. They're going to be playing at the Jorgensen. You know them if you ever watch the show. Whose Line Is It Anyway? So we'll take a little break right here, and we'll come back with them.
This life is a precious gift, so don't get too crazy. It's not worth the risk.
You know that we are still young, so don't be dumb. Don't trust anyone, cause you only live once.
You only live once, that's the motto. So take your chill pills, ease off the throttle.
Hey. Never go to loud clubs, cause it's bad for your ears. Your friends will all be sorry.
And so she says, I'm going to Google it on my phone. Can you believe that, ladies and gentlemen? Google it on my phone. Really? That's a common thing? People have Google on their phones? Like a phone you talk on? I didn't know that. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our intern Greg Dyson, voiceover help in the intro by Cecilia Canavo. The part of Bill Curry was played by Yakov Smirnov. On tomorrow's show, what it means to be left or right-handed. And now, back to Colin.
Colin Mochrie and Brad Sherwood are improv comedians. They will perform October 5th, I believe that's Saturday night, 8 p.m. at UConn's Jorgensen Center for the Performing Arts. On the website, it says there will be sandwiches, soup, salad, dessert. So that's good. I don't think you're required to make the sandwiches yourself. The doors open at 7 p.m. For more information, go to jorgensen.ucon.edu. This is a long introduction. Or call 860-486-4226. I'll say that all that stuff later. Colin Mochrie and Brad Sherwood, of course, legendary for Whose Line Is It Anyway? But, guys, public radio listeners sometimes don't watch that much television. They're too worried about climate change. Just on the off chance that some of them have never saw Whose Line Is It Anyway, give them a sense of what that was.
Whose Line Is It Anyway is a show that's actually made up on the spot. Getting suggestions from the audience, the actors improvise scenes, and hopefully make up a show before your very eyes.
And in a lot of ways, it was America's introduction as a mass audience to improv. I mean, there are some of us who like it a lot and go to little clubs and see it and stuff like that. But I think for a lot of people, they had probably never really seen anything like that, except maybe when somebody like Jonathan Winters would turn up on an old variety show and do it in his own unique way. One of the things that you guys do sometimes is in your live acts is even bring people up from the audience and assign them tasks. Do you always know that's going to work, that the average person can be brought up on stage and told to make sound effects or whatever it is you're going to ask them to do, and that's going to be okay?
You know, we never know what's going to happen. That's the nature of what we do, is we throw ourselves into the unknown, and part of making it even more unknown is just bringing regular audience members up and expecting the worst and hoping for the best, really.
Although I suppose sometimes the worst is the best, right? I mean, if people are not up to certain tasks, that can be funny.
The beauty of improv is, you know, everything is fodder. So if it goes well, that's great. If it doesn't go well, sometimes that's even better. Because Brad and I find that the more trouble we're in, the more fun we have and the more fun the audience has.
You know, one of the senses I think that people have watching comedy is that the people delivering the comedy can't laugh. They're not supposed to laugh. That's sort of breaking character. It happens once in a while. People usually kind of enjoy it. But usually the comedy people are watching is scripted, it's rehearsed, it's practiced. People kind of know what's going to happen. How much of a problem or a danger is it for you guys that one of you is going to crack the other person up?
You know, I think we're always in the pursuit of trying to make each other laugh as well as the audience laugh. And, you know, we've been doing it a long time, so sometimes we'll just completely lose it. But we can also go an entire show keeping a straight face. It just sort of depends on the mood we're in. We can have a night where we're giggling through the whole thing, but it certainly doesn't hurt our show. It's not like we're destroying the sanctity of two goofy guys running around being idiots. There's nothing much sacred about that.
So how different will the show that people see at the Jorgensen be from a typical episode of Whose Line? Obviously, there'll be fewer people on stage most of the time, but is that whole format of having certain kinds of so-called games, is that still basically intact?
There'll be a lot of games that'll be familiar to fans of Whose Line. It's actually even more interactive than the TV show. Every scene starts with a suggestion from the audience. We have audience members on stage with us. We've adapted some games because there's just the two of us. But it's just as goofy and silly as the TV show.
I have to get back to these audience members on stage again because this fascinates me. And I love it when any act that I'm watching where people are brought up on stage, even sort of neo-vaudeville acts, there was one called The Flaming Idiots where they just made such great use of audience members. But for you guys, you need a certain amount of fluidity up there. You need sort of things to be moving along. Do people from the audience ever just get upstage and really just freeze and not be able to do anything?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, we sort of expect them to freeze, but we make it a safe place for them. So it's never about us making fun of the audience. It's about us giving them the opportunity to put us into precarious positions, and we dig our way out of them.
I mean, a similar thing was done on the show itself, although it tended to be famous people. So you'd get a Richard Simmons out there or a Stephen Colbert. Just talk a little bit about some of the people who guested with you guys, famous people, and how they handled the pretty unfamiliar, at least for some of them, business of improv.
We sort of ran the gamut. You know, we had people like Robin Williams and Whoopi Goldberg, who had done a lot of comedy and improv. We had people like Florence Henderson, maybe not as versed, but was really committed. And, of course, Richard Simmons, who I think gave us one of our funniest scenes. All of them, even if they had no experience in the improv arena, they were all committed to the show. And I think that's what made the scenes work.
I mean, I think the Richard Simmons thing became kind of legendary, partly because he has no inhibitions that I can see anyway. And in that bit, he is more prepared, if anything, than any of you to fling himself body and soul, especially body, into anything you want him to do. Is that part of improv, is just getting rid of inhibitions?
I think, I don't know if it's so much getting rid of inhibitions. It's just the commitment to what is thrown in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, inhibitions don't really play into it in that it's just your mind's inhibition, as it were. Just take the brakes off the train and let it roll downhill and try and pick up as much speed as possible, not censoring yourself. So as performers, I don't think Colin and I are in any way inhibited. It's just constantly challenging ourselves to fly into the unknown more so than freeing our inhibitions.
I was looking at the clips, and I may have this wrong. I looked at a whole bunch of clips. My recollection is on the Richard Simmons thing, Colin, you were on stage with him. I'm not sure that you were Brad, but whoever was on stage with him, was that a case where you thought, wow, this guy's kind of a ticking time bomb? I mean, he could do anything. He could do something that we're completely unprepared for. Was there any sense that you were suddenly working with somebody even more unpredictable than you guys are?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we knew who Richard Simmons was, but, you know, I had no idea whether he had any sense of what it was like to perform in this sort of way in front of an audience. And for us, it's kind of exciting because, you know, we work together as a group, and so we know each other very well. We sort of know what to expect. When you have that added level of, I have no idea what's going to happen next, that's when the fun happens, because you're on your toes and you're scrambling to make the scene work. And I have to say, Richard really made us work.
Are you guys this way in the rest of your life? I mean, are you, I don't know, as you're traveling, you know, dealing with airports and stuff, are you thinking, oh, whatever, it's fine, you know, the unpredictable is good? Or is the stage just kind of one place where you can sort of let a lot of your cares go away and really want chaos to ensue?
I would say that both of us are, in our real personalities, sort of shy, smart asses, a little sarcastic. But when we get on stage, we're far more extroverted.
Yeah, I mean, Colin, you're both Scottish and Canadian. I mean, in terms of
any more introverted than that.
I know, in terms of cultural stereotypes, that wouldn't really point you in the direction of improv somehow. But is there sort of a way in which that does let somebody out who was inside you for a long time before this?
I'll need a lot of psychotherapy to figure right. that out. All I know is when I'm on stage, it's the most comfortable that I am in life. I'm with people that I totally trust, who I know that they're watching my back, and I have a confidence on stage that everything is going to work out, all these things that you don't have in real life.
You know, Brad, just reading up on you, and I almost wondered if these things could be true, but it looked to me as though in the past, before you started doing some of this stuff, you worked in more conventional game show settings. Do I have this right? Were you the host of The Dating Game at one point?
Yes, I did a season of The Dating Game when they brought it back in the 90s. Hosted that, I've hosted a bunch of different shows of game show variety and, you know, reality-based shows. So that's the thing I do from time to time to help pay the bills.
And when you were doing that, I mean, I don't know if it was sort of before you really got discovered as an improv player. I'm wondering if you were doing that thinking kind of like David Letterman being a weatherman. You know, I really want to go a lot crazier than I can go in this format.
Actually, I had already done the British version of Whose Line before I did most of my hosting things.
So you already let that tiger out of the cage.
Yeah, so those were all running concurrently.
You know, speaking of letting tigers out of the cage, one thing that's clear to me now, just once again looking at this, and in fact, one of our producers here told a very cute story of working for a while with a Norwegian exchange student or something like that, who every night would tape Whose Line, transfer it to a disc, and mail it to his mother in Norway. Looking at the just clips of you guys, you're being interviewed in places like India and stuff like that. And I'm wondering, in terms of the points of reference that you draw on, which are for the most part explicitly American and Canadian and Scottish and British, I guess the show must travel very well, or you wouldn't be traveling all these places. But what's it like doing that kind of improv in front of an audience that doesn't necessarily have your reference set?
It kind of, every time we do it, we're always kind of worried, especially when we went to India. We thought, are they going to understand, even though they get the show? But our first suggestion, we got fart. So immediately we relaxed and felt that, oh, okay, we're all in the same wavelength.
It's the universal language.
Exactly. I think the reason the show travels so well is that it's more, it's just goofy. You know, the reference level isn't necessarily towards a particular country or local news. It's just plain silly fun, and I think that's what the audience, why the audience enjoys it.
Our show was, like he said, because it was goofy and it wasn't based on sarcasm or cultural references like most sitcoms, it translates better to someone who has literally just moved to the country and started watching Whose Line, whereas a show like Friends, they're not getting a lot of the references, and sarcasm might be lost a little on them in their second language.
Brad, what was the transition like from the British version? This started out as a British show and got picked up as an American show. You did both. What was the difference? Is British improv substantially and textually different from?
No, there really wasn't much difference. The audiences are a little louder and rowdier in the United States than they were in England. But when we moved to the States to do the show, the only thing that changed was the host. We used to have Clive Anderson on the British version, and then Drew became the host. But we had all the same producers, and by that time, the cast was pretty much the cast that you see in the heavy rotation now. So as far as, and we shot the show on a very similar set. So the transition was almost unnoticeable.
You know, one of the things you'll do, obviously, is come out on stage, and sometimes you'll say, all right, we're about to make up some crap and bring some people up there on stage. And one thing you say a lot in interviews is that you're too lazy to actually write material. It's so much easier to do improv. And obviously, you're joking about that. But it makes me wonder, has either one of you ever done stand-up with prepared material? Would either one of you ever want to do such a thing?
No, I'd never do stand-up. What I love about improv, first of all, you're never alone. So if you actually do die, you're taking friends with you. and I think we have a little more leeway. You know, with stand-ups, the audience is sitting there ready to judge, going, okay, this guy wrote his stuff. He must think he's funny. Let's see. With improv, they're supplying all of our material. So they want us to sort of succeed because they're feeding us all the information. So we have a little more leeway to suck.
You know, I think, it is true that the audience energy is in a very different place. And I think also, I mean, having gone to see a lot of improv stuff live, I always feel as though it is like watching the Flying Karamazov brothers, too. They could drop one of their juggling pins. And you guys, I mean, there's always the sense and the added excitement, even though you're pulling for the whole thing to be funny, there's also the excitement from the audience. It might not be, you know. I mean, what if they can't get anything going? And I think that's part of the energy of it.
It's true. There is a certain element of almost like it's a magic act or something that you're holding your breath to see how it turns out. And I think that added excitement is what really makes the audience like this type of show so much and what sets it apart from a stand-up. You know, a stand-up, you know, he's written this material. He's worked on it for a year. He's got it down word for word. He's tried it over and over again in front of an audience, and now he knows it works. We are literally bringing people up on stage and asking them for suggestions and flying by the seat of our pants. So that is definitely more of a daredevil form of comedy, I think, that excites people because they get to see, they get to think, oh, this isn't going to work, and then it does.
Yeah, I think, you know, the energy of stand-up sometimes, some of the people in the audience are really almost adversarial. They're almost thinking, I bet you can't make me laugh. You can't make me laugh. You're not that good. Whereas when I'm in an improv audience, I think what everybody's thinking is, can they really do this? Are they going to be able to just take these random suggestions and stitch them into something even mildly coherent and actually funny on the spot? So there's almost more of a sense of wonder than there is, you know, any kind of grumpy hostility that you sometimes see with a stand-up crowd.
Oh, absolutely. It's a whole different mindset.
That wasn't even really a question, I guess. But just moving on. If I'd known either one of you guys in high school, would I have thought, oh, yeah, he's going to have a career in comedy? Or were you lurking in the shadows?
I was a lurker. I was planning to become a marine biologist. So I don't think anyone ever thought, oh, this guy's going to go into comedy.
How about you?
I was more extroverted. I was in drama club and doing plays and, you know, always trying to make people laugh. But, yeah, people would have thought he will have a very unsuccessful career in musical theater.
One of the things that I notice is that funny people occasionally, when they get dropped into dramatic roles, are often just terrific. You know, people that I think of as fundamentally comic actors, then you suddenly are watching an episode of Law and Order or something, and they're, you know, playing some really nasty pimp or something like that. They're terrific. I think both of you guys have had opportunities to do some of that. How do you feel about doing non-funny work? Is that appealing to you?
Sure. I would love to. I did a play a couple of years ago, and it was the first time I'd been on stage for like 20 years doing a straight play, and I loved it. It's a whole different muscle.
How about you, Brad?
I would never pass up an opportunity that was brought to me. You know, we're all actors and gypsies, so we take the work that someone puts in front of us. I don't think it's my strong suit, per se. I've done serious things in the past, but generally my bread has been buttered so heavily by all of my comedic endeavors that I kind of just stick with what I do. Just the same way that, you know, Van Gogh liked working in oils and never did sculpture.
Right. I just always feel that making people laugh is such a challenge, is so hard that anything else, any other kind of performing, any other kind of acting would be easy. But maybe you guys don't see it that way. Maybe you know every night as you head out on stage, yeah, it's going to be funny. This is going to work somehow.
Oh, God, no. You just hope for the best. Every time. We're prepared. And that's it. But, you know, so many things can throw the show off. The audience could be a little off. We could be a little off. The show can be going great, then one scene can destroy the whole night. So we're very respectful of the art. And I don't think there'll ever come a point where we're about to walk on stage where we're going, okay, we know exactly what's going to happen. It's going to be a great show.
Well, Colin Mockery and Brad Sherwood, so great to talk to you. They will be performing October 5th, which I'm almost positive is Saturday, at the Jorgensen Center for the Performing Arts. The show's at 8 p.m. You can get there earlier at 7, and there'll be things for you to eat and drink and get yourself into a spectacular mood. For tickets, call 860-486-4226. There's no chance you wrote down that phone number, but that's all right. Colin Mockery and Brad Sherwood, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye, guys.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
I'm Kyone Wolf. That's not, my name is not a joke, it's my name. I mean, some people are like, is that like cayenne the pepper? And I'm like, well, I never heard that one before. And no, it's not like cayenne the pepper. Really? This is funny for you? I don't get comedy.